welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Just enough to keep the lights on in Kyiv. This seems to be the new approach adopted by the EU and possibly even the United States. One thing is clear, Ukraine is losing and will never win. The only mission left is to deny Russia victory. Crosstalk in Ukraine, I'm joined by my guest, Peter Kuznick in Bethesda. He is a professor of history at American University, as well as co-author with Oliver Stone of The Untold History of the United States. In New York, we have Jim Kavanaugh. He is a political analyst. And in Philadelphia, we cross to Aaron Good. He is a political scientist, historian, as well as author of American Exception, Empire and the Deep State. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Peter, let me go to you first in Bethesda. Thank you for coming on the program, as always. We just had the European Union, after blackmailing Hungary, to agree to a new 50 billion euro a package for Ukraine. It covers 4 years. It's some direct revenue injection and some loan guarantees, which I doubt will ever be paid back. I'm calling this program Kyiv on Life Support. Is this life support in the wrapped up in virtue signaling from the EU?
Well, right now, life support is pretty welcome in Kyiv. When it looks like you're almost dead and you've got very few options, and you're running out of money, and you're running out of ammunition, and you're running out of manpower, a little bit of life support looks like a welcome gift right now. As you say, it's 50 billion over 4 years, which is not very much. The U.S. proposal is to send $60 billion immediately, and that would be an infusion that would make a little bit of a difference.
Difference would it make?
It would keep it going longer. It would prolong the fighting, prolong the slaughter, and the word in the West is if we can get somehow through 2024, 2025 will look much better. So then the Ukraine will be ready for a new counteroffensive with new weapons, and this one will work. And so we just have to get through, bite the bullet, since we don't have very many bullets, have to be careful about which ones we're biting, and in the short run. And so it's a strategy of throwing more and more human manpower into a desperate situation that's going to, a year from now, or 2 years from now, certainly not be any more promising from a Ukrainian standpoint for any kind of so-called Ukrainian military victory.
Yeah, but Jim, people in Washington know this, people in Brussels knows this, and people in Kyiv know this. So this is kind of futile? I mean, it's almost to the point of just being cruel. Jim.
Well, this is the strange frame of mind that people get in. You got to believe it, even if you know it's not true. And they think that, you know, they're writing op-eds saying, oh, we're going to pull back and go on defense. We're going to build up Ukrainian drone industries, and we'll come back, as Peter says, in 2025. And they've got to tell themselves this. And you know, it is a strange thing. It's one of these. The world is getting more absurd, as well as more horrible and more cruel. You have this vision of you watching people who know and say that they're losing, and then they dream up these scenarios. They're talking to themselves about this, and they're telling themselves, "Well, it ain't over yet because we can do this, that, and the other thing, and we can imagine certain scenarios that will come back and win the day." In the meantime, they really discount the fact that there's this other party there, Russia, that's going to act and going to do things that, you know, disrupt their fantasies of what's happening. And not only Russia, there are the Ukrainian fascists who they think they have under control all the time, and they don't. You know, you have this drama going on between Zelensky and Zelensky right now, which the Banderas are in the background, and the Americans don't really have total control of that. So you have this situation where people have lost control of things. They're putting them on life support, like on ventilation. you know, it's like the COVID. A lot of people want ventilators. The ventilators kill them. This is, you know, you're giving them life support. You're giving them ventilation, and it's going to end up just making them go down harder. And
well, I mean, Jim, this influx of money will just continue the conflict, kill more people, and Ukraine will just get smaller. I can't see how that's a winning proposition. Aaron, let me go to you. There is an alternative theory to the case, though, of course, and it's called the grift. Okay, keep it going. So the money is sent there, everybody gets their cut, okay, and then you wait for the next tranche, okay? And this is the same leadership in Kyiv that is completely indifferent to the destruction of their young men. I mean, you can say that's an opinion, but that's actually a reality if you look at the demographics. Aaron.
Yeah, they are, the leadership is in a position where it is a grift for them, and there's been a considerable amount of corruption. We don't know where all the money has gone that we have sent them. And for them, the incentive is to keep this going. And also the disincentive is that if they were to go against the war effort, they could find themselves, you know, ousted or murdered. I mean, I think they even murdered some of the peace negotiators in the early days of this war when they returned for dubious reasons. So we're now in the stage where what the U.S. empire wants is totally infeasible and not possible, but they cannot adjust to this reality. And now they're just wanting to apparently keep it going, perhaps until the election. I don't even know if that is possible. The average age of the Ukrainian servicemen keeps going up, which is on the one hand, thinking how sad it is that there's these 50-year-old guys or 60-year-olds even. If the average age is 43, then some of them have to be a good bit older than that. But then you also stop and think about it. That's not as sad as these 20-year-olds who have already died, because at least the 50-year-old has lived to see 50. What we've done to this country is beyond imagining. We were upset about the people coming home from Iraq and Afghanistan, but those numbers are minuscule compared to what Ukraine has seen with a much smaller population. I don't see how they can disguise what a horrible, horrible disaster this has been, and how it's a total failure on every level, including their ability to, or their the imperative to always establish deterrence, right? So that no one will challenge you again. Well, they look so bad in every way, and it's a strategic failure on pretty much every level for the U.S., and now they're just wanting to extend it so they don't have to acknowledge that it's happened.
Yeah, well, Aaron, and you forgot that other category of people that have really benefited and profited off of this conflict, okay, which, because there's no accountability of where the money and weapons have gone. Peter, I'm sure you came across the news that Victoria Nuland visited Kyiv 10 years after the crime of the Maidan coup, and she had some really kind of quizzical things to say, like... I can't remember the exact words, but there could be some really unpleasant surprises for Russia in this year. What do you think of that?
What can you say?
Yeah, well, I don't know what to say. That's why I asked you. I'm sorry. Go ahead. You know,
it's of the West.
It's just heartbreaking to watch this, and the thought that, you know, maybe Russia breaks through. Maybe the Ukrainian army collapses. Maybe Jim was talking about Zelensky, and you know, so Zelensky says he's going to replace Zelensky and ask Zelensky to resign. And Zelensky told him, you know, forget it, I'm not going to resign. I mean, there's the possibility of this unraveling. Zelensky is more popular than Zelensky is right now. And in the military, I mean, could there be a military rebellion against Zelensky if he replaced him? So it's when that whole thing was breaking that Nuland quickly rushed over there.
Yeah.
In order to, I'm not sure what she's trying to do. You keep on hearing the word coming out of Washington is that, well, this is an internal Ukrainian matter, and we're not going to get involved, and we're happy whichever way this turns out. But clearly that's not the case. And so Nuland's going over there to do damage control, but it might not be possible to do damage control. Every day there's more rumors. And, you know, so if Zelensky goes ahead and fires him, so who does he put in charge? Budinov? I mean, the situation there, on top of the military stalemate to disaster, whichever is going on, on top of the failed counteroffensive, on top of the manpower crisis and the arms crisis, then you've got a political crisis. So it's looking increasingly bleak, and it's very hard to paper it over now. It's very hard to put a positive spin on this for the United States. The only thing that saves the United States from being appropriately chagrined by this whole thing is that the focus in the U.S. is totally on Israel and Gaza right now.
Right.
The headlines are no longer about Ukraine. They're not even about Taiwan anymore. Now it's really about Israel, which also looks pretty terrible. So the Biden administration is in a real bind, because more than 60% of the American people are strongly opposed to what the U.S. is doing in Israel now. And among young people, it's like 80% are opposed. So Biden, from a political standpoint, his hands are, well, if they're not tied, but he's not doing
well,
what America
Well, Peter, I would say, you know, if they're tied, let me go to Jim here, they're tied by his donors. It's obvious on both conflicts here, Ukraine and the slaughter in Gaza, is the bidding of the donor class. The hell with public opinion. That's exactly the message the Biden administration is sending. Jim.
Yeah, look, you've never seen it more clearly that the representatives don't represent the people. They represent the donor class. Look, the Democratic Party has shut down. They need democracy within the party. There are no elections. There are no debates. You know, there's no question about the fact that this president, whom everybody says we don't want him to be president anymore, you know, and everybody knows can't really and isn't really doing the job. Well, we're going to stick with him. I don't think they will. I think they'll replace him, but they're going to not allow anybody to be helping choose to whom to replace him with. They might do it at the convention, but they'll do it behind in the closed room with the donors. So we've never seen this. The discrepancy in all of this in Ukraine, and, you know, nobody asked for this. Nobody wants to send tens, hundreds of billions of dollars to Ukraine when people in the United States can't have health care and can't afford.
Well, Jim, as we approach the break, and then the media, mainstream media, gives him coverage every step of the way. Ukraine, Gaza, and the impoverishment of the American people. Gentlemen, I'm going to jump in here. We're going to go to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on Ukraine. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. To remind you, we're discussing Ukraine. Okay, let's go back to Aaron in Philadelphia. It's quite remarkable, after the conversation we've already had on this program, to mention that there are still voices inside of NATO land that say, yes, on the 75th anniversary of NATO's creation, we should invite Ukraine to the alliance here, which, of course, is the predicate for the Russia's special military operation denying Ukraine membership in an alliance, which Russia sees as an adversary here. Nothing seems to penetrate these people. Facts on the ground, reality, and plus there's so much on social media and alternative media that you can get, the story is getting out. It's an utter failure here, but it's not stopping the decision-making people in NATO and in Washington.
Right, there, for a while, it's been pretty clear that the only way you would have a dramatic reversal on the battlefield would be if you took measures that would invite nuclear war. It's one of the more bizarre spectacles in the history of U.S. foreign policy. It's a more clear failure and more unwinnable, I think, from the beginning, when it should have been clear to everyone, than Vietnam or Iraq. I mean, these are, it just is a more ridiculous conflict than anything that I recall seeing in my lifetime. It's so many people died, and it's been so steady. We don't even know what the number is. Is it 500,000, perhaps, of Ukrainians? And they still are out there putting out little stories of military successes and so on that you can read this online. I don't understand what the thinking is, because it just seems that it will ultimately make the humiliation worse and more obvious to everyone, and it'll make all their narratives about everything else even less credible if they care about this. And yet they're going on acting as though they have some basis to speak optimistically, or that there's any hope in victory here at all. It's I've never seen anything like it.
Yeah, Peter, because at the end of the day, this really has almost nothing to do with Ukraine and Ukrainians. The reason why the Biden administration and the EU want to keep this going is that they somehow want to deny Russia a victory or satisfaction, but they're willing to use the Ukrainians as their cudgel here. And that's what makes it even more cruel, because at the end of the day, Ukraine, it's not about Ukraine. It's about denying Russia security. Peter.
Well, that's from a Russian perspective.
Yeah,
I could see
yeah. Well, it's good to hear the Russian perspective once in a while.
But from other perspectives, you know, you can see it somewhat differently. I mean, Ukraine was invaded. Now, was Russia provoked? Absolutely. But from a Ukrainian perspective, you can understand why they're resisting and why they fought very, very bravely. And had initial battlefield success.
Yes, but then they also had the opportunity. They also had an opportunity to make peace in April after the February of the special military operation. They had that opportunity, and it was denied them, but not by the Russians, by the West. Go ahead.
They had the opportunity to prevent this from happening in the first place. I mean, we've known since 2008, Putin made clear that he was not going to tolerate this, and we ignored all of his warnings, and we ignored what he offered on the eve of the invasion. And then, as you say, there was a chance to end this in early 2022, we passed on that, or Boris Johnson goes in there and undercuts that, and then the United States reinforces that. So we're saying from a Ukrainian perspective, there's a reason for them to try to resist up to a point. But at this point, they've got to let reality get in there. Because as Aaron was saying, their losses have been catastrophic. And it's only going to get worse. And there's a lot of dissent within Ukrainian society. And they see them sending their young men there, and not so young, as we were saying, as cannon fodder. And they're going to the front lines, and they're not trained, and they're getting slaughtered. We're going to be back here a year from now. From a Ukrainian perspective, the best they could hope for is a stalemate, and the likelihood of that happening is very negligible. They're going to be in worse condition. So this fantasy about 2025, the reality is probably whether it's Biden or Trump after the election, they're probably going to find a way to end this. We should end this before, because we could save tens and scores of thousands of lives and destruction there. But we don't seem to have any wisdom, any statesmanship coming out. And now the focus is elsewhere.
Yeah, but Jim, I mean, Peter just said, you know, the Ukrainian perspective. Well, I don't see where the Ukrainian perspective is. If Victoria Nuland is flying in to adjudicate a power struggle in Kyiv, where is the Ukrainian perspective, okay? I mean, they're on life support. I mean, there's no agency. They've denied themselves their own agency. The only thing they have is to give blood. This is what empire does. Jim.
Well, I think you're right. This is a completely client state. The United States has taken it over. The war is run by American generals. I mean, the French correspondent said this a year and a half ago. I went over this. This whole thing has been run by Americans. The Americans, well, there is a Ukrainian perspective. There's the Banderite perspective, which is there, which is the very strong political movement in Ukraine that has a kind of veto power over what happens in Ukraine. And as we see, what the Americans did, they invented this character of Zelensky as a celebrity, as a kind of rock star. And that's why, from their point of view, if he goes away, that's a bad thing, because the Western public and the American public was nourished on this with the, you know, oh, look at this hero Zelensky. But in Ukraine, there are other things going on. There's a discrepancy between Zelensky and Zelensky and what they represent. People are very upset with what's happening with the loss of their sons. And even daughters and fathers now on the battlefield that's going nowhere, and nobody seems to have a plan, because there is no possible plan to do anything about it. So the Americans are isolated from, they don't really know what's happening in Ukraine. But you've got American foreign policy wonks who think they can manage everything and think they're going to figure a way out of this. And we'll find it, we'll put an end to it when we want to put an end to it. And I'm just going to say, you know, Russia has action, has agency here. And they're going to, I think it's going to be put an end to by Russia. And, frankly, at some point, Russia must, you know, actually have an offensive that wins serious territory and makes clear that the reality on the ground is irreversibly different and is never going to be changed.
Well,
and it's not going to be managed away.
Jim, there seems to be growing indications that that is the case, that an offensive is in the works here. I have no inside information about that, but even it's coming out in some Western media outlets that there's a buildup going on. You know, Aaron, one of the tragic things about this, and I'm going to agree with Peter in Bethesda, is that, you know, the longer this goes on, the more people they lose. And I would even say the smaller Ukraine gets. And if they're cut off from the Black Sea, then it's a rump state. And then at the end of the day, Brussels, I guess, will get their wish, and it'll be some kind of adopted bastard state, which will all be encouraged to continue to be against Russia. I mean, this is, again, has nothing to do with Ukraine. It has to do with policymakers in the West. Aaron.
Well, it's hard to say exactly what it will end up looking like. I had figured for some time that the 2010 election map is going to end up looking like what the rump state looks like, which would be a landlocked.
That's a good point. That's a really good point.
It would be a landlocked state, and there'd be some sort of basis for arguing for that as being self-determination for the people in more Russian friendly regions of Ukraine. So that may be what it looks like. But as far as what the state would be able to do going forward, they could join the EU potentially, although that would cause some problems for some EU people with the cheap labor and other problems that they have. But also, would Russia really tolerate them becoming a part of NATO at all? I don't think Brussels would have them see them joining that. So they would be, if they try to put any military hardware in there, I think that Russia will just... I mean, Russia can insist basically on something like the Platt Amendment for the rump state of Ukraine, where they reserve the right to intervene whenever, if there's going to be military installations put in there. It'll be a difficult problem for them to manage. But the thing that makes more sense for people even in the Ukrainian parts of Ukraine would be to have some modus vivendi with Russia going forward, because I do think the whole center of gravity in Europe is going to shift towards the east, even as much as the U.S. has been trying to stop that with blowing up the Nord Stream and everything else. I think that we could end up with a situation that's different than people expect, because at some point the Ukrainians have to realize that the source of their woes is not Russia. It's really the United States.
Well, Aaron, the problem with that, and Jim has already brought it up, is that we have this, what scholars would call Galician nationalism, this ethno-nationalism. It's very fascistic in its nature, and they do have a sway in Ukrainian politics. And the Americans and the Europeans know that. Peter, that is a problem for Ukraine as well, because Russia will not tolerate this kind of regime on its border. Because it's just pure, it's hostility. Peter.
The question is, how tired are the Russians also? You know, they've got an election.
They're less tired than the Ukrainians, I can guarantee you that. Okay.
But less tired might mean that they're still tired, and that they might be willing to accept a deal where they get what they already hold, willing to stop the fighting.
No.
You don't believe so.
Absolutely.
Absolutely
not. Then that is a strategic defeat. And what was it all for? Okay, what was it all for? No. We talk about agency in this program, but I have to remind everyone, I'm amazed that I have to. Russians have agency too. They had agency in the Donbass when they were being shelled for 8 years, and the world never recognized it. But Russia too, to this day, has agency. Go ahead, finish it up for us, Peter.
But Peter, Russia is also suffering as a result of this. Russia is also suffering catastrophic losses. This is the long-term impact on the Russian economy is not going to be a positive one, and there
we'll
is
see.
A lot strong. There is also some strong sentiment in Russia to want this to end. I mean, I've lived through the wars in the United States, and there's sentiment.
Well, I can tell you and our guests and our audience, there's more of an appetite to win than to call it off. We'll see how it goes.
Russia is already winning.
Yes, and it's going, it will win, and it will be a battlefield solution, because that's what NATO has determined. Gentlemen, we just got into a debate here, and we ran out of time. I want to thank my guests in Bethesda, New York, and in Philadelphia. And, of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time, and remember, Crosstalk Rules.